This is Brother Peter Diamond here with William Albrecht, and we were going to be debating the issue of, are the post-Vatican II claimants to the papacy true popes? This is going to be a serious debate with a flexible format, and so we'll let each other speak, but there will be a lot of interaction. If we need to go to a more rigid format, we will. And if a person or one side still refuses to let the other side speak at that point, it will be basically a concession that he can't face the facts. So he said that he wouldn't mind if I began. And so basically the irrefutable proof that the post-Vatican II claimants to the papacy are not true popes is the fact that they are not Catholics. The Church teaches that all who deny Catholic teaching automatically cease to be members of the Church and lose office in the Church. It's been dogmatically defined that all heretics are outside the Catholic Church. And all the doctors of the Church who have addressed the issue of what would you do if you were confronted with a man who claims to be the Pope but is in fact a manifest heretic, they all teach that he would cease to be the Pope automatically without any declaration. And we've had over 40 anti-popes in Catholic history. We've had very confusing periods such as the Great Western Schism. And when you look at the evidence that the post-Vatican II claimants to the papacy are heretics, it's simply overwhelming. I mean, we can prove it if we just looked at what they teach vis-a-vis Islam or what they teach vis-a-vis Judaism or Protestantism. They teach that false religions are acceptable. They teach that false religions are worthy of esteem. They teach salvation outside the Church. They teach that Protestants shouldn't be converted. They teach that the leading schismatics are members of the Church and even pastors in the Church. They teach it's acceptable to worship with false religions. They engage in condemned interreligious worship and apostasy with false religions. They teach that Islam is an acceptable religion. They've agreed with Lutherans on justification. They've taught that the Council of Trent no longer applies, and on and on and on. And so there is absolutely no way that anyone who's a Catholic could regard these people as inside the Church and holding the faith, and therefore they cannot be true popes, but are in fact anti-popes. If you wanted to respond to that, you could. Go ahead.
All right, yeah, I would like to respond to that. I think it'd be best to, I guess, respond point by point. I don't think I'll have enough time to, but if I do miss any of the points that you brought up, you can bring it out. I guess the first point that I noticed that you brought out was you referred to certain individuals that I would consider as valid popes as heretics. I guess before I continue, am I allowed to ask you a question right now? Can I ask
Go
you
ahead.
A question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. I'm just curious if you are aware of the biblical meaning of the term heretic.
Yeah, it refers to choice or choosing something that you want to follow rather than what God decrees that we must follow in His revealed truth. Why?
Okay. Are you aware of the times the Bible uses the term heretic, specifically that term?
Yes. What about it?
Yeah, can you point out to at least one reference in the Bible where it uses the term heretic?
Titus 3:10. St. Paul says that we are to avoid the heretic after the second rebuke. And in fact, St. Robert Bellarmine, who wrote on the issue of how a heretical claimant to the papacy would lose his office, he cites that very verse, and he says that this is an example of how you could not have a heretical pope because you cannot avoid your own head. And so if the biblical precept is that you must avoid the heretic after the second rebuke, then that proves that you cannot have a heretical pope because you cannot avoid your own head. And so that very verse provides further confirmation of the truth of the Sede Vacantis position, that these guys can't be popes, and it actually shows that the position that they are popes is directly contrary to what we see taught about heresy in the New Testament. But let me ask you a question now, unless you want to continue.
Well, I wanted to respond to that.
Okay, go ahead.
I noticed how you pointed out to Titus 3:10. Are you able to point to any other verse which uses such a term?
Well, St. Paul talks about casting out those who do not follow the traditions, and talking about, for instance, in Matthew 18:17, Jesus talks about how those who refuse to hear the church, let him be to thee as the heathen and the publican. So it doesn't use the term heretic, but it illustrates the same principle. I believe that that might be the only reference to heretic in the New Testament, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, you're correct. That is the only reference to heretic in the New Testament. I guess the reason I'm asking this question is because I guess the way I understand the verse, I read Titus 3:10, and then I move on to Titus 3:11. And of course, I'm reading from the New American Bible rendering. You can read from, or you can, if you want, like to read from another rendering, that'd be fine. But we move on to Titus 3:11. We realize where it says, realizing that such a person is perverted and sinful and stands self-condemned. According to what I understand, I believe that we see a heretic as one who refuses to recognize their faults, even after being confronted with them, and therefore stands self-condemned, even after being admonished. Excuse me. I don't think that you're able to prove or able to show any proof of any of the popes that you label as manifest heretics as having continued in obstinate behavior, even after being admonished. And as far as I understand, according to the biblical usage of the term heretic, we can find this biblical context, it shows us that it is in reference to an individual that is admonished, and if they continue in their heresy, then they are condemned. In other words, the individual is a heretic for the very reason that he stands self-condemned even after many admonitions. And I don't think you'd,
let me respond to that. That the admonition can come, it doesn't need to come in the form of a personal admonition, but it can come in the form of the teaching of the church. And that's why Pope Leo XIII, who wrote a whole encyclical on the unity of the church. And see, we have to understand the scriptures, how the popes have taught, how the authoritative teaching of the magisterium has understood them. And Pope Leo XIII says that anyone who dissents, even in one point, from divinely revealed truth, rejects all faith, and he must be considered as alien to the church. Okay? Those who dissent from the authoritative teaching of the magisterium must be considered outside the church, even if they haven't had a formal admonition. And that's why Pope Pius VI condemned the following error in Auctorum Fidei, 1794. He said, "The proposition which teaches that it is necessary, according to the natural and divine laws, for either excommunication or for suspension, that a personal examination should proceed, and that therefore sentences called ipso facto have no other force than that of a serious threat without any actual effect, false." So that idea is condemned, that someone cannot be a heretic or considered a heretic unless he's been personally warned by an official or a judge. And that's why St. Robert Bellarmine says the same thing in commenting on this. He says, without any excommunication or declaratory sentence, they are considered outside the church. And they know all about Catholic teaching. I've read 25 of Benedict XVI's books. He's very familiar with the councils of the church, and he rejects them. He teaches that Vatican I is not even binding upon the Protestants and the Eastern Orthodox. He teaches that getting them to accept Vatican I is not the way for Christian unity. That's what the people they put in place teach. John Paul II signed agreements that we shouldn't convert the Eastern Orthodox. He approved the Balamon Statement, which specifically teaches that very thing. That is manifest heresy. They know about these dogmas. They're not ignorant of them. So they're obstinate, and they're clearly, without any question, heretics. And so I was going to ask you a question now, if that's all right.
Well, I would like to continue a little bit with this. I wasn't allowed to finish the point that I was attempting to make. After I make this point, you can ask me whatever you like. I don't think you're fully understanding the force of Titus 3:10 as followed by Titus 3:11. You went off in a bunch of different directions, but I think you're missing the whole point. We see that, let me check this out. Okay, we see heretical man. We see anthropon is used for man in the accusative masculine form. In other words, the form of the sentence, as far as I'm reading, as I understand, leads us to realize that the individual is in heresy for the very reason that he denies the truth after being admonished numerous times. Well, of course, I don't have time to respond to all of the other arguments you're going into. I don't think we're going to get into much meaningful discussion if you veer off into to a bunch of different topics, but sticking to this one point of the term heretic, according to the biblical usage, and this indeed is the only place where we can find the term in the New Testament, you cannot prove that any of the popes that you claim are antipopes, are heretics.
Let me ask you a question. Word. If someone knows of a dogma, okay, and then teaches contrary to that dogma, is he a heretic?
If a person knows of a dogma and teaches contrary, absolutely, the person would be a heretic.
Okay.
If they're going against the dogmatic teaching of the faith,
okay, that's
without the individual heretic. Unless, of course,
that's what they do.
No, I just completely disagree. I don't think you have any way to prove that point that you're attempting to prove right now.
So you don't believe that they teach contrary to dogmas?
I do not believe that any of the popes you label as manifest heretics, according to the biblical usage of the term heretic, I don't think any of them fit that criteria.
Well, but we have to understand the term heretic the way the church teaches it. And the church teaches that those who dissent from an authoritative teaching of the magisterium are to be considered heretics. That's the teaching of the church. And so your claim is that they actually do not contradict the teaching of the Catholic Church.
Absolutely.
Okay, are you familiar with the joint declaration with the Lutherans on justification?
Absolutely. The Bible was put together by the Catholic Church, so I do believe that we can use the Bible as a clear definition for the term heretic.
Right, and
I don't think that you're using it in the biblical term. Far from it.
Well, actually, your argument proves nothing at all. Titus 3:11, where it talks about how he's condemned by his own judgment, simply reiterates the truth of divine revelation that heretics bring the sentence down on themselves ipso facto. They don't need another to bring it down by virtue of the fact that they've departed from the teaching of the church, and that's why the Second Council of Constantinople says that very thing. He says that the heretic leaves the church by his own judgment, by his own decision to not conform to the teaching of the church. And so let me ask you this. Is the joint declaration with the Lutherans on justification heretical? Do you know anything about it?
Yes, I do know. I do know about it. If you like, I can pull up the document. I do not believe it's heretical. And on a point you mentioned, if I'm allowed to touch on a point you mentioned just a little while ago, you say that Titus 3:11 shows that the individual is stands self-condemned. I don't know if you'd mind if I ask you, Titus 3:10 and 3:11, what is it exactly that makes this individual a heretic?
By the fact that he refuses to conform to the rule of the Catholic faith. By the fact that he refuses to submit his mind and accept Catholic teaching.
So after a first and second admonition, we can clearly see that this individual is then a heretic, because since he doesn't want to listen, he doesn't want to recognize, or he refuses to recognize the false, even after being confronted with him. He then stands self-condemned.
Well, it's not only talking about the concept of what makes people heretics, it's also incorporating the concept of avoiding heretics. And so that's why there's also a discussion of after the second admonition. But all of your points prove nothing at all. Okay, they simply
can... Well, you haven't responded to them.
Oh, yeah, I have. Yeah, because you admitted that someone who dissents, who knows of a dogma and teaches contrary to it, is a heretic.
Your items, but I don't admit to your interpretation of the papal documents. And again, this verse...
No, I asked you a question. Is someone who teaches contrary to a dogma a heretic?
I answered that question already. I didn't.
Okay, so you agree. So what it really comes down to... Let me finish. Okay, what it really comes down to here is whether they are teaching contrary to dogmas. Okay?
And absolutely.
And in the joint declaration with the Lutherans on justification, they... agree, they teach that the condemnations against Lutheran teaching in the Council of Trent no longer apply. That is blatantly heretical. That is to state that dogmatic canons no longer apply. They also teach that faith alone is not condemned by Trent, even though justification by faith alone was specifically condemned by Trent. They teach that the other Lutheran heresies, such as totally just and a sinner at the same time, is not condemned by Trent. That is manifest heresy. What would you say in response to that?
You're cracking up. I can't hear you at all. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, I can hear you clearly now. Okay.
Okay. So,
I missed the last thing that you said. I missed the last thing. Right after you said faith alone, you cut off.
Yeah. In the joint declaration with the Lutherans on justification teaches that the canons of the Council of Trent, which condemned Lutheran teaching, no longer apply. I'll quote it. This is number 3. Quote, this joint declaration shows that the remaining differences are no longer the occasion for doctrinal condemnations. Quote, that's blatantly heretical. It also says, in light of this consensus, the corresponding doctrinal condemnations of the 16th century do not apply to today's partner. And so the anathemas that the Council of Trent issued against Lutheran teaching and the Lutherans no longer apply according to the heretics Benedict the 16th and John Paul II. That is
right. Were you finished?
Go ahead. You can.
Okay. In the sense of the current understanding, in the sense of the way Lutheran teaching has evolved, they would definitely in certain aspects not apply, because in the sense of speaking of faith alone, it's definitely not referring to the biblical sense, Calvinist or the Lutheran sense of intellectualist sense only. It's referring to faith alone as well can be viewed in an orthodox manner, and that's simply the way that we see the term being used here. In that sense, faith alone definitely would not be heretical, and some of the condemnations definitely would not be valid today, because as understood, and if you would read some Lutheran teachings, you would find this, a lot of the teachings of Lutheranism have evolved, and in essence, Lutherans, you really can't find them believing what they believed back when Martin Luther was around. Ever since Luther passed on, the teachings have been in a state of evolution.
Yeah.
So in the sense of referring to Trent, it's definitely not contradicting Trent in any way at all, because if the Lutherans were to still believe the exact same teachings that were condemned by Trent, then it would definitely be heretical. They would not be able to have any joint declaration. None of the terms would be able to be understood in an orthodox manner. In that sense, there would be no joint declaration whatsoever.
Well, that is what you just said is blatantly heretical. The Council of Trent... it's a fact. The Council of Trent declared in Session 6, Chapter 10, you see that by works a man is justified and not by faith alone. It condemned the ideas of faith alone 13 different times, approximately. Let me finish. Okay. And in fact, when it justifies the Lutheran idea of faith alone, it says, quote, according to Lutheran understanding, God justifies sinners in faith alone, sola fide, end quote. And so it says that is not condemned by Trent, the teaching of the Lutherans on faith alone and the other heresies. For instance, in this joint declaration, it also says that, quote, number 29, Lutherans understand this condition of the Christian as being at the same time righteous and sinner. That's Martin Luther's classic heresy, that those who are justified are not truly interiorly sanctified. Okay, it says it's not heresy. This is Lutheranism being justified here. Okay, it also says in number 21 of the Joint Declaration, human beings are incapable of cooperating in their salvation. That's not condemned according to this heretical agreement. And even if what you were saying was true, which is not, it's insane and absurd, it would be proven to be heretical, because it says in number 5 that it shows that the remaining differences are no longer the occasion for doctrinal condemnations. That's heretical, because they don't accept the Council of Trent. And the very fact that they don't accept the Council of Trent, no matter what they believe, that is a proof that they are in heresy, and they are condemned by Trent. And so it's saying they're not condemned anymore. That is an example of blatant heresy. And to deny it is just to be a liar.
I guess I'm not going to get into any accusations of calling anybody a liar. I think as it's evidenced in your attempt at exegesis of Titus 3:10, I think you're simply confused. You went on to quote what faith alone meant according to the ancient Lutheran understanding, and that definitely is still in condemnation. You come out saying, reading that, I don't know what your point was. I think maybe you completely misunderstood what I was attempting to explain, that faith alone can be understood in an orthodox sense, as it is used numerous times by many church fathers in a completely orthodox sense. I guess you completely misunderstood that. I mean, do you think that I agree to faith alone in the ancient Lutheran sense of the term?
Well, see, here's the blatant error you just made. You said that I was quoting the ancient Lutheran teaching. Actually, I was quoting the Joint Declaration. Okay, so that proves my point, that the Joint Declaration is justifying the classical Lutheran heresy. And so you first denied that, and then you just admitted that, because when I quoted that, you said, I'm quoting the ancient Lutheran teaching. No, I was quoting the Joint Declaration, William, which is blatantly heretical.
I wasn't talking about...
But let me ask you this. Is it heresy? Is it heresy for Lutherans? Is it heresy...
Point first before you move on. I mean, I would like to finish my point.
Okay, go ahead. You did ask me a question. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't asking any question. Previously, but anyway, you brought up, I wasn't referring to the fact that you were quoting, the portion you were quoting, What I was referring to was your interpretation when you mentioned what Lutherans believed, when you mentioned the doctrine of sola fide. That is what I was referring to. I wasn't referring to when you began to quote the Joint Declaration. And once more, I'm simply asserting that sola fide can be interpreted in an orthodox manner. Of course, when we cannot hold, it would be heresy to hold that one is justified by faith alone and the intellectual assent of it. But we can definitely view it in an orthodox manner, as many of the early church fathers did. And I simply think that you're misinterpreting the Joint Declaration completely.
No, I'm not. Let me ask you this. How can this be interpreted in an orthodox manner? Quote, human beings are incapable of cooperating in their salvation. That's Joint Declaration number 21.
Let me look that up. And that is the Joint Declaration to the Lutherans?
Yeah. And the Council of Trent, by the way, says that if anyone shall say that man's free will moved and aroused by God does not cooperate by ascending to God who rouses and calls on and on and on, let him be anathema. And
so, can you read that quote to me one more time so I can go ahead and find it and read it?
According to Lutheran teaching, human beings are incapable of cooperating in their salvation because as sinners they actively oppose God in his saving action. And so that's just blatantly heretical. It's insane that you can't cooperate in your salvation. It's directly condemned by the Council of Trent. And so the notion that it's not justifying Lutheran teaching, I mean, you just have to be a liar to say that.
Well, I would agree with you. It definitely, it can sound heretical, but I think you're taking it completely out of context. Human beings are unable to cooperate in human salvation without the grace of God. If one does have the grace of God, as it's the doctrine sola fide, they are able to cooperate with God, but of course salvation comes from God and God alone. And I don't deny that we are unable to cooperate in human salvation if we lack the grace of God.
Yeah, we're not talking about that.
Okay, let me finish. In a certain sense, the Lutheran teaching would be correct, but it needs to be clarified. But then again, I simply don't find any logic in everything you're reading into.
Yeah, an honest person can see. And here's another point for you, that Pope Pius VI, in Auctorum Fidei, he condemned the idea that texts that are ambiguous, okay, can be accepted as orthodox, even though they advance heresies and try to, you know, obscure them. And so if you are confronted with things that tend to heretical meanings and that present heresies, but then they try to hide them in different ambiguous phraseology, you are to hold them to the heretical meaning. Now, this isn't even ambiguous. Any honest person can see this is blatant heresy, okay? But even if someone were to say that there could be some confusion, which there isn't, it would still have to be held as heretical. But here's the question which really cuts through it all. Are the Lutherans, okay, heretical for refusing to accept the Council of Trent? That's my question.
Are you speaking of modern-day Lutherans, or are you speaking of the ancient Lutherans?
I'm speaking of either one. Either one, and Lutherans.
Well, there goes your complete misunderstanding. You're speaking of Lutheranism as a whole. So
Lutherans post the Council of Trent, okay, who refuse to accept Trent. It's a very simple question. You asked for a clarification on my question. I'm giving it to you so that you can answer. Are Lutherans who refuse to accept the Council of Trent's teaching and say, I don't agree with that, I have my own views on justification, are they heretical or not?
Okay, I simply don't understand the question you're posing. Are you unaware of the fact that Lutheranism had various factions within their theology as well? I mean, you're coupling the Lutherans together as if every single Lutheran believes the same thing, and that's ridiculous.
No, I think
maybe you simply don't understand Lutheran teaching because you really aren't making any distinction.
What you're saying is completely irrelevant and ridiculous. Of course they're Protestants who, it doesn't matter. If they don't accept the Council of Trent, they're heretical, William. Okay, it doesn't matter.
You're saying that every single Lutheran denies the Council of Trent. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that every single Lutheran, yes, that's correct. And
you're incorrect. You're completely incorrect about that. I think maybe you need to do a little bit of studying in Lutheran theology.
No.
You're wrong. Yes,
no.
You are.
Lutherans do not accept the Council of Trent. But even if what you were saying was true, that's beside the point. Because I'm asking you a question about Lutherans who do not accept the Council of Trent. It's a simple question. Lutherans who do not accept it, are they heretical or not?
Okay. The certain Lutheran factions that do deny it, if they deny the teachings of the Council of Trent, absolutely they would be separated. Absolutely. They do not subscribe to the way of calling an individual a heretic in the same sense as if an individual understands the teachings of Trent and they understand them clearly and deny them, even knowing that they are the truth, then indeed they would be heretics. But again, you would not be able to prove himself on. That is one of the reasons why I'm very careful in calling individual or individuals heretics, according to the biblical term, which you clearly still don't understand.
No, I do understand.
To call them heretics. You don't understand the term. You weren't able to exegesis at all.
Yes, I was. Your arguments are absurd and ridiculous.
You want to go back to the biblical term? You want to examine it? We'll examine it. Statement by statement.
We've already discussed it,
lost.
William. Okay,
yeah, but lost in the firm. You have no idea what it's talking about.
No, you have no idea what the Catholic Church teaches, because
right.
You admitted that a person who refuses to accept Catholic teaching is to be considered a heretic. Okay, and then you diverted on and on and on about how he must be admonished. Okay, anyone who can think proves.
I use the Bible. I use the Bible. I don't see how I diverted.
Yeah, we don't believe in sola scriptura as Catholics.
Oh, so you don't believe the Scripture is the inerrant Word of God, then?
No, I didn't say that. Are you capable of hearing language? I said.
I'm not preaching sola scriptura, sir.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm using the Bible.
Do you accept what Pope Leo XIII taught, that anyone who dissents from any point of the authoritative teaching of the magisterium is to be considered alien to the Church?
Once again, absolutely any individual that is aware of the teachings of the Church, that knows them farewell and denies them, would be a heretic. I've covered that over and over.
Does Benedict XVI believe that the leaders of the Orthodox who do not accept Vatican I, does he believe that they're heretics?
Does Benedict believe what?
That the Orthodox who do not accept Catholic teaching, the Eastern Schismatics, the, quote, Orthodox, who do not accept papal infallibility, they don't accept Vatican I, they don't accept the supreme jurisdiction of the Roman Pontiffs, okay, he believes that they're in the Church.
He believes that they hold elements and they have valid holy orders. He doesn't believe that they're part of the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah? Well, let me refute that. Common Declaration of Benedict XVI with Orthodox Chrysostomos II, June 16, 2007. A Common Declaration. We assure our faithful of our fervent prayers as pastors in the Church. He says it all the time. And see, we read his speeches almost as much or more than anyone. Okay, Brother Michael's read the last 40 years of Vatican newspaper. He says it all the time. Okay, he did another declaration with the Schismatic Patriarch Bartholomew, November 30th, 2006, and he speaks of our responsibility as pastors in the Church of Christ. He praises their church. He says he loves their church. John Paul II gave a donation to their church. He says that the excommunications against them no longer apply. Okay, he talks about how they have an important ministry, okay, how they were great ministers. He does it all the time. He absolutely believes they're in the church, and that's why he's a heretic.
He definitely believes that they hold elements of the Catholic faith as before the schism, as they did. But I wouldn't disagree with. I'd have to agree some of the stuff that a few of the popes that you label as anti-popes have done is definitely not everything's acceptable. I wouldn't agree with everything, but I would say just as a council that convened in Acts, and just as Isaiah shows us. In context, I believe Peter and his successors hold the keys to the church that God left us, and therefore their decisions, those that I would view as dogmatic, should be respected by the faithful. And I believe, whereas we can question some of their actions, I think we should also look deeper into some of their decisions instead of labeling them as heresy. Once more, I'll go right back to Titus 3:10. If an individual is recognizing that what they're doing is heresy, it's heretical, if they're in full knowledge of the fact that they're being heretical and they persist in it, absolutely, it would be heretical. They'd be a heretic. But once again, I don't think you're able to follow the biblical mandate and show that any of them are heretics, as in the biblical usage of the term heretic.
One fact, Benedict XVI admits that the teaching of Vatican II on religious liberty was a, quote, correction, a departure, an overturning of the teaching of Pope Pius IX in the Syllabus of Errors. Pope Pius IX authoritatively taught that the state has a duty to forbid non-Catholic religions publicly worshiping. Okay, and Vatican II completely contradicted that. And Benedict XVI admitted that it contradicted that. And Casper, Cardinal, quote, Casper, who John Paul II and Benedict XVI appointed to, quote, the position of Christian unity, he admits that before Vatican II, ecumenism was converting people to the Church. He says that this was abandoned after Vatican II. We no longer have the ecumenism of the return. And so they openly admit that they've overturned the traditional teaching of the Church in those areas. And so it doesn't get any more heretical, William. Okay.
Can I reply to that?
Go ahead.
I would disagree with, you know, of course, once again, your misinterpretation of the word heretic. I believe Vatican II is simply reiterating the fact that the state just doesn't and logically could not control the religion of every single individual. It's impossible. Vatican II doesn't say, and I'd be interested if you could show me it did, that you should choose another religion other than the one that Christ left us, or that it's right to do so, morally correct to do so. Logically, it's impossible for the Church to control the religion of every single individual. It would be impossible. That's not possible. So I think you're completely missing the point of what that's saying.
Well, can I respond to that?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. The Church teaches, I don't know if you understand this, it doesn't seem like you do, that the state has a duty to forbid the public expression of false religions, okay? The idea that the state can allow all kinds of false religions to worship publicly was condemned in the Syllabus of Errors, because it can't allow, okay, sinful religions and evil and idolatrous religions to publicly spread their evils against Christ and his Catholic faith. And so that idea that religious liberty should be a civil right enshrined in the state was condemned by Pope Pius IX and numerous other popes solemnly. Vatican II taught that the state, that it's a duty for the state to give the civil right to religious liberty to everyone. Okay, and it even goes so far as to say that the state exceeds the limits of its authority if it takes upon itself to direct or to prevent religious activity. That is directly contrary to the teaching of the Church. It is exactly what was condemned by Pope Pius IX in the Syllabus of Errors. He said, he condemned this: men immigrating in a particular place should be allowed to have the public exercises of any form of worship condemned. And so, and in fact, after Vatican II, Catholic constitutions, such as the Catholic Constitution of Spain, was changed. They didn't allow false religions to publicly spread their teachings, but after Vatican II, they rewrote their constitutions to allow false religions to spread their evils. And so that is the heresy of Vatican II in action. And just to close the point off, Benedict XVI admits that this teaching of Vatican II, he says in Principles of Catholic Theology, page 381, we might say that in conjunction with the texts on religious liberty and world religions, Vatican II's teaching is a revision of the syllabus of Pius IX, a kind of counter-syllabus. End quote. And so he admits that the teaching of Vatican II on religious liberty directly contradicts Catholic teaching.
I have a question for you. As you mentioned, is a civil right the same as a moral right?
No.
Okay. Once more, I would reiterate the fact that you went on and on about this, simply missed the point that I'm simply pointing out that Vatican II is simply reiterating the fact the state doesn't and cannot control the religion of every single individual. I'll point out the very same truth as I can point it out. I travel a lot over there, Mexico. It's impossible for the state to be able to control the religion of every single individual. So in a sense, it is different, because it's impossible to control the faith, and it's impossible to coerce an individual into believing the faith. That simply isn't a Catholic teaching, that you must force a faith on an individual. I mean, it's not biblical, it's not historical Catholic teaching at all. In that sense, I would completely disagree with your interpretation.
Well, yeah, what you brought up has nothing to do with what I said or what Vatican II taught. Vatican II is addressing the issue of, can the state forbid, okay, people from expressing their own religious beliefs, whatever they may be, publicly? And Vatican II says, no, it cannot do that. It says it exceeds its authority if it takes it upon itself to direct or to prevent religious activity. And it says that the civil rights of religious liberty should be enshrined in the law of every ideal state. That is directly contrary to what the Church teaches.
So your opinion is that Vatican II, that the state could control the religion of every individual, and that Vatican II should have said that. Is that what your opinion is?
the teaching of the churches, which is also my position, is that, as Pope Leo XIII said in Libertas, justice therefore forbids, and reason itself forbids, the state to be godless, or to adopt a line of action which would end in godlessness, namely to treat the various religions, as they call them, alike, and to bestow upon them equal rights and privileges. Vices which corrupt the heart should be diligently repressed by public authority. End quote. That's the teaching of Pope Leo XIII, that's the teaching of the Catholic Church, and that's what Vatican II denies.
Well, I completely disagree. I think Vatican II is denying the fact that the state could control the religion of every individual, and I reject your interpretation of that. But
well, you also reject Benedict XVI's interpretation, because he admits that it's a correction. He admits that it's counter to Pius IX's teaching.
I don't agree that he admits it as a correction. What I think Benedict XVI is saying is the same thing as Vatican II is saying, that the state cannot control the religion of every individual. Things are very different nowadays. You can see that it's impossible for the church to control what every single individual publicly professes. Simply, it's illogical. It's impossible in the way the world is. It's not possible.
No, it's addressing... Go ahead.
And I think the fact that it's, as you were going to say, it's addressing the public confession of individuals. It's impossible to prevent.
No, but it's addressing the concept of, if the state can do it, does it have the right to do it? That's what it's saying, okay? If it doesn't have the manpower to do it, then it's obviously not an issue. It's talking about the ideal state, okay?
Right.
What states are allowed to do, what they can do. It has nothing to do with what you're talking about. But let me ask you this. Does a Catholic esteem false religions? And do these Vatican II, quote, popes, anti-popes, esteem other religions?
Does the Catholic faith esteem other religions? I assume you mean, do they praise other religions?
Yeah, that's what esteem means. Look upon with admiration. Look upon as something good.
I guess if you were to examine certain aspects, even whether they be in ignorance or not, we can definitely find the biblical mandate as well as in Paul in Acts chapter 17. He's praising the pagans for being religious. He doesn't support or endorse their teachings, but he says that in every respect that they're religious. And he praises them for being religious. And then he then says that they need to turn their minds towards Christ now, because they were worshiping in an ignorant fashion. So in that sense, I guess it does praise other religions, but it should praise their religiosity and then turn them towards Christ.
No, he's not praising their religiosity. He's simply acknowledging the fact that they at least admitted that they didn't know God, because they were praying to the unknown God. And so by the fact that they admitted that they did not know God, they were a step closer than the utter pagans who claimed to know God but were actually worshiping devils. The Catholic Church does not esteem false religions.
Are you telling me that Paul is not praising the Athenians?
No, he's not. He doesn't praise false religions. And I'll just quote Pope Leo XIII, who says...
He's calling them very religious. He uses the Greek word daimon. How can you tell me here that he's not praising them? I suggest maybe you could open the Bible right now and read Acts chapter 17, verse 22. I mean, maybe you can explain to me what Paul means when he tells the pagans that they are religious. They're very religious, he tells them, in every respect. He later proceeds to say that the pagans are offspring of God. Use the Greek term genos.
Yeah, and what you're saying is completely ridiculous. And in fact, because
you refuted them.
Yeah. Okay. If you would let me, I will. He says right there. He says, but Paul, standing in the midst, said, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious." Okay. This is the Douay Rheims translation. Let me finish. Okay, let me finish. Too superstitious. So the fact that they are engaging in a form of religious worship, he's not saying it's good. And in fact, in the very next verse, he says, "For passing by and seeing your idols, I found an altar also." Okay? And so they are worshiping idols. Okay? And so those who worship idols, as 1 Corinthians 10:20 says, the gods of the heathens are devils. He's not praising that. He's simply acknowledging that they are very superstitious religious people, and the fact that they admit that they are worshiping the unknown God, they're at least a step closer than those who claim to know God. They, in fact, don't know God, and by their admission that they don't know him, they're a little bit closer. Okay, that's all he's saying. But I can refute it further by quoting Pope Leo XIII,
Can I respond to that?
Well, let me just finish, and then you can respond. In Custodi Quella Fede, he says that avoid those, okay, who hide under the mask of universal tolerance or respect for all religions. Okay, he says that this is an apostate opinion. We don't respect other religions, but that's what you're saying.
Okay, once again, going back to the passage that you attempted to interpret, but completely couldn't interpret any of it, I completely disagree. Maybe you want to look up a different translation there. He is not calling them superstitious. In fact, he uses the term daimon in the Greek, and he tells them that they're religious, very religious in every respect. And once again, he later proceeds to say that the pagans are offspring of God. Maybe you should open up the Bible and read a little further. He calls them ganas, offspring of God. And as far as I can see, it's clear that the pagans were not worshiping God in the Orthodox sense. But nevertheless, Paul recognizes their religiosity. He praises it and then tells them they need to turn towards Christ because it is now time for their ignorance to be eradicated. I mean, the point is that ignorance would not condemn an individual. You need to prove that ignorance condemns an individual. And if you are of the persuasion that ignorance condemns an individual, then you have to show me why Paul is referring to the pagans as ganas and calling them religious in every way. And I simply don't think you're able to. In fact, and I'll move it a little further, Acts 17:29, he said, "Since therefore we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divinity is like an image fashioned from gold, silver, or stone by human art and imagination." He's definitely praising them and then telling them they need to turn towards Christ.
Okay, can I respond to that?
Let me just finish my sentence. The way they're worshiping is definitely incorrect, but he's nevertheless praising them and telling them they now need to turn towards Christ.
Yeah, he's not praising them. The fact that he calls them very religious does not mean that he esteems their religion. He's simply acknowledging that they are very religious people. They're very superstitious people, just like the Hindus who worship 30,000 some idols and false gods. Excuse me. Okay. And in fact, he says that we're all offspring of God. Okay, Acts 17:28. He's speaking of the fact that we all are created by him. Okay, he's not saying they're children of God. That's blasphemy. That's why John 1 says that those who accept Christ, who believe in his name, become the children of God. But you're implying that the pagans who worship idols, as he says there, okay, who are blind in their darkness, are the children of God. That is totally heretical.
That is precisely what I'm saying. That they're
yes,
blind.
and that is why you are a religious indifferentist. And but you, I don't think I received a direct answer to the question. Does the Catholic esteem false religions?
And I answered it to you with a biblical passage. And once again,
so the answer is yes.
I will point out to you that in this passage, there is no use of the word superstitious. You continue using it over and over, and I guess you're unable to deal with the biblical text. Once more, he says that the Athenians, which are pagans, are religious in every aspect. And furthermore, he says that they are offspring of God. They are worshiping. I'm not saying that we are to praise other religions for the way they worship, but nevertheless, he sees how religious they are, and he tells them that they are offspring of God. They need to turn to worship God the correct way now.
Yeah.
They're worshiping in ignorance. And
yeah, I've already responded to this, but you didn't answer it. Yes or no question. Does the Catholic esteem false religions or not?
I just answered it for you.
So the answer, yes, that's what you believe. The Catholic.
No, I did not say that. I never.
What's your answer? Yes or no?
I answered with a biblical text telling you.
You can't give me an answer.
Individual, I'm attempting to answer, but you're speaking over me. If an individual is worshiping contrary to the Christian faith, that definitely cannot be praised at all. But if an individual is in ignorance and they are attempting to reach the truth to the best of their capacity, the individual should be told, you know what, I can see you're religious, but you need to turn towards Christ. This is the true faith. This that you're worshiping, as Paul tells them, is actually the one true God. You're not worshiping. There are no false deities. There's only one God. And in that sense, no false religion should be praised. We should praise the fact that they're attempting to reach the truth to the best of their capacity.
Okay,
and
so
in that sense,
all right. So
we should turn them to
so you God. you your answer is yes, and the
I answered it clearly. I never said yes. I explained. Why? I explained the whole qualifier.
Do you accept the teaching of the... Do you accept the teaching of the Council of Florence, which declares that the Church condemns, rejects, and anathematizes whoever holds opposing or contrary views to the Church, and also that it execrates and condemns every heresy that suggests contrary to the Catholic teaching. Do you accept that the Church condemns and anathematizes and execrates every opinion, every religion, therefore, that is contrary to Catholic teaching?
Every single religion and every single individual that are aware of the faith, that is the Catholic faith being the correct faith, and they are obstinate, and they continue in choosing their religion, even if they know the Catholic faith is the true faith. Absolutely, the individual gets.
Okay, well, it doesn't say if you know it's the true faith. That's not taught in the Council of Florence. Okay, it doesn't teach that.
The Council of Florence, depending on what you're talking about, it's not even referring to what you're speaking of. There's no section where it touches upon many of the false religions of today.
Oh yeah, it says that all the pagans, all the Jews, all the heretics.
My point is, it's not referring to every single religion. I agree in the sense that every single religion, and if you read the context of the Council of Florence, every individual that realizes that, of course, the Catholic faith is the one.
Where does it say that in the Council of Florence, that what they realize? It doesn't. Where does it say that in the Council?
The Council of Florence, I'd have to pull up the
document. It doesn't say it anywhere. I'm very familiar with the Council of Florence.
You're very incorrect. In fact, I responded to I believe it was an article you did on Limbo, where the very fact that you attempted to show something from the Council of Florence, and the Council of Florence was definitely speaking of something completely different. It's not speaking to individuals that are ignorant at all. You've got to read the context of the Council of Florence. And once again, let me finish my sentence. I don't know if you deny invincible ignorance, but there's an exception. If an individual is ignorant, there's no possible way you can condemn the individual. It's not logical. It's not possible. Definitely an individual that is a pagan is a heretic. An individual that is a Jew and knows full well the Catholic faith is a faith, is the correct faith, and they continue in their faith in an opposite manner, they would be a heretic and they would be condemned to hell. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and that's not the teaching of the Church, and in fact, in more than 7 dogmatic definitions on outside the Church, there is no salvation.
So I can get water, it'll be like maybe 10 seconds.
Okay, well, I could take a break. I have to go to bathroom.
Okay, okay.
About
how long?
45 seconds.
Gotcha. All right, I'm back. Okay.
And so in response to what you were saying about the dogma outside the Church, there's no salvation, and these statements about pagans, etc., only applying to those who know the true Church, that is completely contrary to Catholic teaching. In more than 7 ex-cathedra statements on the issue, never once were any exceptions mentioned. In fact, they're all exclusive. All exceptions are always excluded in 7 definitions on this. And we have to keep in mind that Vatican I declared that we must believe dogmas as Holy Mother Church has once declared, and there must never be a recession or a departure from that meaning under the specious name of a deeper understanding. And so if what you're advancing does not conform to what was originally declared, it is heretical. Okay, and none of the saints and missionaries believed what you're saying. Okay, they all believe that all the ignorant pagans are lost. I've studied the missionary. It's one of my favorite topics. For instance, St. Isaac Jogues, St. Francis Xavier, who preached the gospel to heathen areas, they all knew the Catholic teaching that those who die in those lands, they're in darkness. Okay, they're worshiping false gods. They cannot be saved. And in fact, if what you were saying is true, which it's not, it would be a disservice to convince them of Catholic teaching, because then only those who are convinced would be culpable. Okay, so you're convincing them, and now they can go to hell for rejecting the truth. It's totally ridiculous, and it's not what Scripture teaches either. And for instance, about ignorance, Pope Benedict XV taught in Humani Generis Redemptionem, 1917, ignorance is the mother of all errors, as the Fourth Lateran Council so truthfully observes. Okay, and the errors of Peter Abelard, condemned by Innocent II, and that whatever is done through ignorance must not be considered a sin, condemned. Okay, so it's not like, well, they're ignorant, they're excused. No. And, in fact, St. Thomas Aquinas and others who address the issue of people in ignorance, they point out that if someone was of goodwill among them, they'd be brought into the truth. All right, and so, but the Council of Florence says that all the pagans are lost. It's talking about all the members of religions which worship false gods, etc. And so Benedict XVI is an apostate, as is John Paul II and Paul VI, for esteeming false religions. Here's what Paul VI says. The Church respects and esteems these non-Christian religions. Here's another quote, 1977, non-Christian religions, which this Church respects and esteems. Benedict XVI, catechesis. We have esteem for the other great religious traditions. This is apostasy. Okay, here's another address to the Italian Bishops' Conference, 2007. Esteem and respect for all other religions. Okay?
I see what you're getting at. Whereas I would completely disagree with your interpretation of ignorance. I think you don't have any grasp of the knowledge of the doctrine of invincible ignorance at all. I probably would pick a different wording to some of the things certain popes have said since the very beginning, actually. I would disagree with every single comment you made about Florence as well as invincible ignorance. It doesn't even touch upon the topic. You claim that the Bible is against me as well. I wonder if you're aware of John 9:41 and how you would respond to what John 9:41 says.
I'd have to look up the verse. I mean, what about it?
I'll go ahead and I'll read it. I'll read the NAB rendering. 41, Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin, but now you are saying, we see, so your sin remains. I was wondering since you're claiming that individuals are ignorant, they're still condemned, how would you interpret that verse?
I would interpret it because he's talking about the fact of his coming. If he hadn't come at all, okay, then they wouldn't have sinned for not believing in him. And in fact, St. Augustine, in interpreting John 15:22, I believe it is, which is a similar passage, he points out, let me just read that. He said, this is John 15:22, if I had not come and spoken to them, they would not have sinned. But now they have no excuse for their sin. And St. Augustine comments on this, and he says, not that they would be saved, but that they would be excused for the sin of not believing in Christ, directly contrary to your argument. So he addresses that very point, and he says not that they could be saved if he hadn't spoken to them, but that they wouldn't have the extra sin of rejecting Christ. That's the teaching of the Church. It's called the sin of infidelity or rejecting the gospel. But that is not does not say that the people who are left in ignorance of the gospel are saved. That is why Pope Eugene IV says all those who are outside the Church, all the pagans, all the Jews, all the heretics, okay? So you would have to believe that a Jew, okay, who is not convinced of Jesus could be saved.
Okay, you're completely misunderstanding what the verse is saying.
Right. Well, you're the same person who said that the Council of Trent declares that this is my body, this is my blood, is all you need for the consecration. But I'll finish this point and then I'll let you respond. And the Council of Trent mentions nothing at all about the words of consecration. If you had read the Council of Trent, you would have known that. And that displays that you don't have the first clue about Catholic teaching, but go ahead.
Okay. I'll get to that later. But John 9:41. Once more, the term for blind used here is tufloi, and it is in reference to ignorance, as can be found in other biblical connotations. And we're specifically told that a person is in ignorance, you want to go ahead and look at the term, if they haven't heard the message, and it is not speaking of just seeing Christ, speaking of the message of Christ as a whole, Christ himself coming to the world and judging the world, they would have no homartia, the Greek word for sin. And I assume the fact that you can't deal with this passage is the reason. You jump into many other passages, you jump off topic, you start talking about a bunch of other things, and I'm going to ask you one more time.
I answered the passage. I answered it right away. Yeah, I pointed out that he's talking about if he hadn't come at all, okay, then they wouldn't have that sin. And furthermore, let's look to the tradition, okay?
And individuals.
Let me finish.
You've been talking for quite a while.
You asked me a question.
Yeah, but I didn't get to finish asking.
Go ahead.
I was very really going to ask you. In this passage, I was going to ask you, can you explain this passage in light of your denial that those that do not hold the Catholic faith to the fullest will perish? Can you explain this in reference to the terms that I just pointed out, the fact that you will not have sin? I mean, how can you say that these individuals will perish? I can't follow your logic. It's shoddy. Can you explain it?
I did. I said that he's speaking there of the concept of if he had not come at all, okay, they wouldn't have sin. Okay, and furthermore, as we understand the Scriptures, and see, actually, that's why you are a Protestant. You understand the Scriptures according to how you want to believe them, not according to what the Church teaches. And let me give you some, not only, I already quoted the dogmatic teaching, but let me finish my answer. St. Augustine, okay, who understood the scriptures, he says, quote, consequently, both those who have not heard the gospel and those who having heard it did not receive perseverance, none of these are separated from that lump which is known to be damned, as all are going into condemnation. So he says, all who haven't heard. Pope St. Pius X at Cherbonimus, April 15th, 1905, encyclical on ignorance. Okay, he says, we declare that a great number of those who are condemned to eternal punishment suffer that calamity in hell because of ignorance of those mysteries of faith which must be known and believed in order to be numbered among the elect. The teaching of the Catholic Church, which you do not accept, is that there are certain mysteries of Catholic faith, namely the Trinity and the Incarnation, which every person above reason must know without exception to be saved. That's what the Church has always taught. That's what the doctors of the Church taught. That's what the Holy Office replies teach. And that's actually why Pope Benedict XIV says in Cum Religiosi number 4, 1754, that people who are ignorant of these mysteries, they stand at the tribunal and they're ignorant of what he must, by necessity of means, know to be saved. So there are certain mysteries which are necessary by necessity of means. That's why Pope Paul III in Sublimis Dei 1537 says that, speaking of the pagans in the newfound lands, he says that none may obtain salvation save through faith in Jesus Christ. He doesn't make any exceptions. That's why Pope Pelagius I in 557, early on, he speaks of the wicked, okay, remaining wicked by choice, who either did not know the way of the Lord, or having known it when seized by various transgressions, continued in it. And so he's saying that the wicked are those who didn't know the way of the Lord. That's why Gregory XVI, Morari Vos, says that those who do not have the Catholic faith, who are left outside of her, are not saved. That's the teaching of the Catholic Church.
I would agree those who do not have the Catholic faith are definitely not guaranteed of their salvation. But once again, I simply notice how immediately I bring up an inerrant document, such as the Bible, and you move on to quoting a bunch of saints completely out of context. I simply don't see how you're dealing at all with the passage. And
how is the quote I given out of context? You've probably never even seen the quote.
Let me continue, because it's not referring to John 9:41. That series is not in context. You claimed right now that I was a Protestant. I think maybe you're under the errant impression that John 9:41 has been infallibly defined by the Church, and it hasn't been infallibly defined by the Church. Therefore, I'm not going against any teaching of the Church at all. And once more,
yes, you are.
No, I'm not. You can't deal with the text.
Yeah, I can. If you interpret a scripture that even if a scripture hasn't been,
well, I've been speaking for quite a while, and I would like to just finish what I was saying.
Okay, I mean,
I don't cut you off when you're speaking for a while. I just want to finish my point.
Okay, go ahead.
You said just a little while ago that an individual, even though it's ignorant, basically blind, because this term twofold that is used is in reference to ignorance, they're condemned to hell. John 9:41, Christ says the exact opposite of what you're saying. He's definitely saying that the individual has no sin. The Greek word for homartian, you go off into quoting a bunch of different things. It'd be nice if you could stick to this one text instead of jumping off into a bunch of other texts. I mean, can you exegete the passage, or are you going to continue saying that it's referring only to the appearance of Christ? It isn't referring only to that. It's referring to the message of Christ. He's telling them, do you believe in the Son of Man? He's asking them if they believe in him and his message, not only in believing and seeing him. He's talking about the message as a whole. These individuals that before they knew or before they heard the message, they had no sin. They were in ignorance. Therefore, they were not condemned. They would not go to hell. Now that they know the truth, they have no, their sin remains because they're no longer blind. We see the term we see now, where they are no longer sinners.
You're right, and I've already addressed this. But one thing I will point out is that when you interpret any scripture contrary to the teaching of the Church, that is heresy. Even if the church hasn't issued any declaration on that scripture, it is not saying they can be saved. And you put yourself in contradiction to not only the teaching of the popes that I quoted, Pius X, Benedict XIV, the Holy Office Decree, the Athanasian Creed, Eugene IV, the whole tradition of the early church, all the missionaries who all believed all the pagans were lost, and St. Augustine, who interprets a similar passage in John 15:22, that it's just talking about the sin of infidelity. And in certain contexts, Jesus is also saying that if he hadn't come at all, okay? And so, but getting back to the issue of Benedict the 16th, do you believe that Benedict the 16th believes that the quote Orthodox have to accept Vatican I to be saved? Does he believe that?
That they need to accept Vatican I? I mean, I'm aware that a lot of them do not accept Vatican I.
So are they outside the church for not accepting Vatican I?
They would not have the fullness of the faith, absolutely. They would not be. They would not contain the fullness of the faith, but once again, it goes back to the point that I've been mentioning over and over. So it is still possible for these individuals to be saved.
Where's the church ever taught that? Can you quote anything where the church, where a pope before...
Yes, I'm going to quote it for you. It's even better when I quote scriptures, and since the Catholic Church put the Bible together, it's the inerrant word of God. I just quoted it for you. If an individual is in ignorance, an individual has no sin.
That is condemned. That is condemned. I just quoted... Yeah, I just quoted... Right. You're a guy who doesn't even understand English grammar. Okay, on the front page of your site, you say, I want to defend the faith of Jesus Christ to its fullest, IT apostrophe S. IT apostrophe S is it is. So you're literally saying, I want to defend the faith of Jesus Christ to it is fullest. What you should say is ITS without an apostrophe. And so your claims about, you know, all this stuff, it means... No, ITS is not the possessive form.
Okay, if you want, we can argue the English language at a later time. But how about you stick to John 9:41? How about you try and tell me why the term?
Wasn't this a debate on the Vatican II quote Pope?
Absolutely, and we're going to the topic of invincible ignorance, and you can't deal with any of the biblical texts.
Well, yeah, I did. Right. Sure. Okay, how about we do this, that you can go for 2 minutes, and then I'll respond. And then I'll go for 2 minutes. And you can present your evidence, and I'll respond.
Hold on, let me get a timer.
I have a timer.
You got a timer?
Yeah.
Well, I don't want you to just, like, talk over me, so let me start mine. I have a timer right here. Give me a second. Okay, are we going to... are we going to be speaking, or are we still going to be engaging with each other and asking questions?
Well, I think that we've come to the point where we need to impose a more rigid format. Because
we'll be talking over each other, but we can still ask each other questions, I believe, right?
It's obvious that you have nothing to present. You just want to spend all day on this thing that's already been addressed and refuted.
I have a lot of arguments.
Yeah, and so we need to move it forward, okay?
That's why I'm asking you if I'm allowed to ask questions later and you can respond. Because I do have arguments I would like to present. And am I allowed to ask questions? Do you need a response?
Okay.
No, am I? I'm asking.
Go questions. Ahead.
Okay. Let me go ahead and... All right. I'm going to be dealing with your first audio presentation. It's labeled as your first on your website, I believe. And when I say you, I'm not sure if it's yourself or the other Brother Diamond. So, excuse me, but I don't think you all would have contrary views, anyone, this topic, since it's on your website. But let me ask you the question. In your first audio presentation...
What's the title?
I do not know, but it's labeled as your first audio presentation. I mean, I don't think it has a title. You label it as the very first one.
We have lots of audio presentations. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about.
You want me to go to your website and tell you which one it is?
Okay, just ask the question. I might know. Go ahead.
Okay. In your first audio presentation, am I being timed right now?
Well, you can ask your question, then I get a few minutes to respond.
All right. In your first audio presentation, later in the presentation, you connect Revelation 18, which says to come out of the whore, to be tantamount to saying come out of the false church. And then you go on to say that it talks about certain things and details of this false church. Do you still hold this position that this is in reference to the current church that I would consider the Catholic Church, that you consider the Apostate Church?
Okay, you're going to give me some time to respond. It is my opinion, it is our opinion, and this is not necessary to prove the point that they're not popes, that the Bible, when it talks about the great harlot, okay, on the city of Seven Hills, and it clearly contrasts that with the Bride of Christ, it's talking about a counter-church in Rome in the last days, and that's why the great harlot only emerges in the apocalypse, and it's clearly contrasted with the Bride of Christ, which is the church, and that's why it treads upon the blood of the saints. Okay? That's why it's a mystery, because it purports to be the true church, but in fact is a counter church. It's drunk with the blood of the martyrs. That's why we see Benedict XVI, okay, praising false religions, Islam. We see John Paul II engaging in the worship of false religions, praying with animists, going to the temples of heretics. Benedict XVI went to the mosque and prayed toward Mecca like the Muslims. Okay, that's an act of apostasy, according to Catholic teaching. And since they've disseminated this heretical teaching among the counter-church, the Vatican II Church, and caused people like you to fall into apostasy and into a perversion of Christ's gospel, which renders the necessity of Christ meaningless, it is the great harlot. It's a counterfeit construction which is leading people to hell. And there's no doubt that Babylon refers to Rome. Okay, that's clear. But that's just an opinion, which really, frankly, is not even necessary to get into, and people could have different opinions about what that means. But we can see it that the Vatican II Church is totally heretical, and they respect false religions, as I said. He holds interreligious prayer services with pagans, animists, etc. That was explicitly condemned as apostasy by Pope Pius XI in Mortalium Animos. John Paul II approved the Balamon Statement, which declares that it's outdated to try to convert the Orthodox. I'd like you to address that as we continue. As I mentioned, they approved the John Paul II said, may St. John the Baptist protect Islam. Vatican II teaches that Buddhism leads to illumination. They teach that false religions are respectable. They teach that non-Catholics may lawfully receive Holy Communion. They teach universal salvation, on and on and on. So it is a counter-church. There's no doubt about it. But whether someone believes it's the Great Harlot, I personally do, that's not central or necessary to prove the point.
All right. I guess I'll deal a bit more with you went off into a bunch of other topics, as you usually do, instead of dealing with the one topic that I'm trying to address. You mentioned this, and I do believe it's important because you mentioned one of the topics in your very first audio presentation. And I guess I'm not going to go on talking for a long time. I want to stick to this one topic of Revelation 18. I'll ask you a question. Maybe you can answer it quickly because it's a very simple question. Can you show me one instance in Revelation 18, since you're making the logical connect, which I believe is logical, that this is a false church that is being referred to? Can you mention one instance in Revelation 18 where the biblical term ecclesia is used for church?
Well, the term isn't necessarily used, but just like the term Trinity isn't used in the Bible, the reality is there. It's indicated clearly because it's contrasted with the bride of Christ, and that's why throughout the Old Testament God refers to his people when they would fall into apostasy and separate from his true worship as a whore. Okay, so the biblical imagery is obvious, that it's clearly contrasting this, the true church, the faithful bride, to this counter church that has fallen into apostasy and become a whore in the city of Seven Hills. Okay, and in fact, Pope Benedict XIV, addressing in an address on May 5th, 1749, a true pope, he spoke of Rome, and he spoke of how what was once the earthly Babylon has been transformed into a new heavenly city. Okay, it's now become the resting place of the martyrs. And so he speaks of how it was pagan Rome was considered Babylon, okay, spiritually, and it's become Christian, but in the last days it will give way to apostasy. And so you have papal authority here confirming that when it talks about Babylon, it's talking about the city of Rome. And we have Our Lady of La Salette who said Rome will lose the faith and become the seat of the Antichrist. We have Jesus who says in Matthew chapter 24:15 that the abomination of desolation will be in the holy place. We have St. Paul who says that the man of sin will sit in the temple of God, and that there will be a great apostasy. And so we have a spiritual deception that's predicted. The doctors of the church teach that the mass will be taken away in the final days. Okay, and so we've had anti-popes in church history. We had a horrible crisis in the Great Western Schism. And if those don't constitute the great apostasy, okay, with the great spiritual deception reserved for the end, what will that be? And that's what we see right now. And all you have to do is believe in Catholic teaching and look around. We've got Benedict XVI praising the leaders of false religions. He's not a Catholic.
Okay, it's been 2 minutes, right?
What's that?
Well, we're doing the 2 minute thing, right?
Well, go ahead. You can respond.
I'll respond by saying, I gather you can't, once again, we're off into a bunch of different topics. You can't show me one passage from the term.
Well, let me cut you up, and then you can continue. Varying off into a bunch of different, we are debating the issue of whether they're popes, so when I bring up what they do, that is quite relevant, but go ahead.
Okay, I would agree that it is quite relevant. I don't agree that it's relevant to veer off into different topics. I think we're dealing with Revelation 18. I think that if you present that as one of your proofs that we are in a false church, I think you've got to prove that. I can notice that you can't deal with this term. You make the logical disconnect that the city of Rome, which you're interpreting this as the city of Rome, you're then connecting it to a false church. There's nowhere any mention of any church here. And I'll ask you one more question. I suppose you can go out. You can, it'd be nice if you could respond to it specifically instead of going on into other terms. It's a really simple question. Is there any place in all of the scriptures where reference is being made to a church or churches and the term ecclesia is absent from the biblical text?
I didn't hear what you said at the end.
Okay. Is there any place in the Bible where a reference is being made to a church or churches and the term ecclesia is absent from the biblical text?
There might be. I'd have to study that issue. What's your point?
Okay. The point is, in other words, you're reading the Revelation 18 what you want to.
No, the fact that the term isn't...
Can I finish?
You asked me a question, okay, I'm responding. Yeah, and so the fact that the term isn't mentioned doesn't prove the reality isn't there, just like the term Trinity isn't mentioned, the term papacy isn't mentioned, but the reality of the papal office is there. The reality of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is there. Okay, just because the term church isn't mentioned in reference to the great harlot who is contrasted with the bride of Christ, and St. Paul describes the church as the bride. Okay, so it follows logically to anyone who's not in a complete spiritual fog that the great harlot would be a counter-bride, a counter-church. So, and furthermore, you said that this is one of proofs. This is just supporting information. This is just extra information for people to consider that, yes, this explains why we're seeing this. I don't need to quote that and give my opinion on the great harlot to prove the point. Their heresies prove the point. The fact that Benedict XVI says Protestantism is not even heresy. Okay, did you know he says that?
You've gone on and on. I wasn't able to finish my sentence, so I'd like to respond to what you were saying.
Okay.
I can tell that you keep using the argument of the Trinity because you simply don't understand this passage. And I understand why you would use that argument. I hear that argument brought up a lot by Protestants, by a lot of individuals in Protestantism. They simply don't have an answer to a passage. And I do believe this passage is very relevant and quite different from the term Trinity. We can find the Trinity everywhere in the Bible, present throughout the whole Bible, the doctrine of the Trinity is there. And explicitly, whereas we don't have the term mentioned, it is explicit. But the clear difference here is that each time we find a reference, we find the term ecclesia present in the text, and it isn't present here. You can do a little search of that if you want later. This is relevant because you've used this passage a number of times in your audio presentations, and you're making the connection that this, you're connecting a church here, you're connecting the city which you interpret as being Rome to being a false church, and then you're also making the interpretation that this is in reference to the last days. I mean, I don't understand how you can make any of these connections. Where does the text even imply that this is referring to the last days?
Do you believe that the apocalypse pertains to the last days?
Some of it, absolutely.
Okay.
What is this text?
There you go.
What is this text?
And so, therefore, it's a and therefore, it's a very reasonable opinion to believe that things which are said of in the apocalypse, in Revelation 18, it speaks of Babylon falling. It has fallen. Okay, speaking of something that will happen, that it's applying to the last days. But again, we don't even need this. I mean, your opinion is, here's a question for you. Does the reference to the bride of Christ, okay, the woman, do you believe? Well, I mean, it's just pointless to continue on this issue. Now, you asked me a question about Revelation 18. I can ask you a question now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess we'll do that. We'll flip-flop asking questions.
Sure. Okay. I asked you earlier about whether the, quote, Orthodox, who don't accept Vatican I, are in the church, and you didn't answer. You said partially. My question is, are they inside or outside the church? And is it necessary to have, the church has defined that there's one faith in the church. Is the papacy an essential article of faith?
Okay, can I go?
Yeah. Is the papacy in a... Go ahead.
Yes, the papacy is an essential article of faith, and whether the Orthodox are in the Church, once again, we can deem any individuals as whole aspects of the faith, the whole partial aspects. We don't have, we would view the Orthodox as not having the fullness of the faith, since they don't hold to every single dogmatic teaching of the Catholic Church. And
okay, so they don't hold, by the fact that...
I got 2 minutes to respond. Let me finish. I would say that the Orthodox simply, there's some aspects that they do not hold, but there's some aspects that they do hold. We can clearly see that the Orthodox are definitely not united in this point, as we can see in John Meyendorf's writing. There are some, indeed, that view that Peter does hold primacy in the Church. In fact, a lot of them, I would say the ancient Orthodox teachings that Peter definitely does have primacy in the Church. There are some nowadays that would deny this teaching, and those that do not deny this teaching are definitely missing a portion of the faith. In that sense, they do not have the fullness of the faith.
Okay, and Vatican I teaches that whoever deviates, whoever refuses to accept the Catholic teaching on the primacy of jurisdiction, papal infallibility, etc., which they do not accept, is a heretic and outside the Church. He loses the faith. Okay? And you cannot be in the Church if you do not have the faith. So you admit it's an essential article of faith, but you believe that someone who denies an essential article of faith is in the Church. So you believe that the papacy, really, is not an essential article of faith, because you believe that the Orthodox who deny it are still in the Church. How can they be in the Church, William, when they deny an essential article of faith?
Okay, once more, I think you're really misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm not claiming that they hold to the fullness of the faith, nor am I claiming that every single one of them is within the Church.
Are they schismatics?
They are schismatics. There definitely are some individuals that do hold elements of the faith, and as such, I am nobody to condemn them as heretics or say that they are condemned to hell.
So schismatics can be saved?
Hold on, let me finish what I was attempting to say. Can schismatics be saved? Are you referring to the Orthodox?
You said they're schismatics. They are schismatics.
In this reference, you're referring to the Orthodox. Yes, absolutely. There are some Orthodox individuals that I am assuming, of course, can be saved. It would be logical to believe that every single Orthodox individual has no capacity of being saved.
Even though he rejects Catholic teaching.
Okay, once more, we'll go right back to the same issue.
It's a yes or no question, William. It's a yes or no question.
It isn't a yes or no question.
Yes, it is. For a Catholic, it is. Okay.
It isn't a yes or no question.
That's why Jesus says in Matthew 5.
I thought I was going to be given 2 minutes to respond, though, and just speak it over and over and over. It isn't a yes or no question, because quite simply, I'll go right back to the point. An individual can be saved, or if they do not accept an article of faith, if they aren't aware that article of faith is indeed the truth. If there is an Orthodox individual, and understands that article, such as the papacy, the primacy of the infallibility of the Pope, the primacy of Peter, if they understand it, and they understand that it is the truth, and they fully reject it, indeed they cannot be saved, and they are condemned.
Okay, do the people who meet with Benedict the 16th, okay, like Bartholomew and these other, quote, patriarchs, who meet with Benedict the 16th, they obviously know him, they obviously understand his position, they do not believe it, so they know it, they understand it, they don't believe it. Are they outside the Church for schism, or are they inside the Church?
An individual that understands, once more, such as Bartholomew, excuse me, if an individual such as Bartholomew would understand the position, which, of course, logically, he does understand the position, and they would reject it, and he understands it fully, of course, he cannot be. But, once more, the load of individuals that you can quote from the may understand the Catholic position, but the key thing is they do not accept it as truth.
Well,
and whereas the key point is, if an individual understands that this is truth, which they, as we can clearly see in their writings, they do not understand that this is truth. If they understood it was truth and they would continue to be obstinate, as Titus 3:10 tells us, they would definitely be a heretic. That's a very simple, plain simple point.
Okay, I'm going to respond for 2 minutes. So you admitted that someone like Bartholomew, who meets with anti-Pope Benedict XVI and knows his position, doesn't agree with it. He's a schismatic and outside the Church. Well, Benedict the 16th doesn't believe that. That's the point, William. Benedict the 16th, as I quoted earlier, joint declaration with the schismatic patriarch Bartholomew, November 30th, 2006, calls him, says, our responsibility as pastors in the church. Common declaration with, quote, Orthodox Chrysostomos the 2nd, 2007. We assure our faithful of our fervent prayers as pastors in the church. So he not only says that those who know of the papacy and reject it are inside the church, that's blatantly heretical, that proves that he denies Catholic teaching and Vatican I, but he says that they're pastors in the church, meaning that they have jurisdiction. If you believe what Benedict the 16th says, frankly, you have to be a complete idiot to want to be part of the Vatican II Church. You could just be Orthodox, because he believes that the Orthodox are in the church and can be saved. He praises their churches all the time. And as I said, John Paul II approved the Balamon Agreement, which explicitly rejected converting these people, okay, converting the, quote, Orthodox. He rejected it as outdated ecclesiology. It doesn't get any more heretical than that. They are therefore manifest heretics, and as St. Francis de Sales says in the Catholic Controversy, now when the Pope is explicitly a heretic, he falls ipso facto from his dignity and out of the church. A manifest heretic cannot be pope, and that's why Benedict the 16th and John Paul II consistently teach that the Orthodox are not under excommunication. We have canceled the excommunications from the history of the church. That's what they teach. And so that's about 2 minutes. Can I just take a 45-second time break?
Yeah, I need more water as well.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
Okay.